All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now shifting our focus over to the oil, natural gas sector, old school energy, as we're chatting with Joseph Schachter. Joseph is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report, also writes the Eye on Energy Report on Substack. I'll post a couple of links in the show notes where you can follow along with Joseph's reports and get the rundown on what's happening in the oil and gas prices, as well as the companies that Joseph follows. Joseph, let's start with oil. I don't know how long we're actually going to stick on oil, the underlying price, because quite frankly, it's continuing to be pretty boring. We're recording this earlier in the week on Tuesday. Oil price right around $63 a barrel. It's been here for a couple weeks and quite frankly, seems to have established almost a lower trading range. Peak being around $70 a barrel and the floor being a little under $60 a barrel. Joseph, what do you think? What's going to drive oil here? Could we be seeing higher prices, or is this just a market stuck in kind of limbo right now?
Yeah, I think the higher prices will have to wait for winter. Demand picks up from the shoulder season. Again, you know, this week's data from the EIA on Wednesday, next week's EIA data will be the September long weekend, so people will be driving. But after that, we get back to what we call the quiet period in between, where you have in the spring slowdown and in the fall you have a slowdown, and demand falls by 1.5 to 2 million barrels from the summer peak and then from the winter peak. So I think we're going to see, if we have a moderate winter, we're going to see $75-$80 pricing. But in the meantime, what I'd be watching is once we get into early September, if we start seeing inventory builds, 5-10 million barrels a day, or sorry, 5-10 million barrels a week, I think we're going to see a breach of $60. I think we've talked about that in April when I started watching the shoulder season again, the spring one, where I thought we were going to see big builds in inventory, which did occur, and then we saw the low in April in the mid 50s. I think we're going to go back below 60, maybe 57 to 59 sometime in October, and that will give us another buy signal, just like we got in April, which was a table-pounding buy signal. I think we're looking at something like that in October. The index would be in the 230s, the S&P TSX Energy Index, 57 to 59 on the price of oil, and I think you'll find bargains galore, and if the bullish percentage index is under 10%, we will be sending out action alerts with a lot of recommendations for buys. And I think people should be doing their homework now. Look at the Q2 numbers. We're going to be reviewing the Q2 numbers of the companies with good results on our webinar on Thursday night. And so people can go into the archives afterwards, become subscribers, and they can listen to the webinar. But the webinar is really a feature that we do once a quarter, which gives a chance for us to go over what we see as the highlights. And then we have two Q&A sessions where people can ask questions and we cover stories that they're interested in. And many of them send us the inquiries beforehand. And then I have one-on-one chats with management so that I'm updated as fully as possible to answer their questions. So bottom line is near-term lower oil prices below 60. Once we get into winter, 70 handle is there. And I think we could see 75, 80 before year end. And then if the winter in 26, a part of it, Jan, February is cold, we could pounce between 75 and 80. So I think we're heading in the right direction after this shoulder season.
All right, folks. So you heard it here. Definitely click on the link below in the show notes and subscribe to Joseph's service to get access to that webinar where they dig into the companies that did well in Q2 and some of the companies you want to put on your watch list and do more due diligence on. So if we see oil pull back into the high 50s, like you say, it could be a table pounding buy at that point, especially if you expect higher prices towards the winter. Let's also just broaden the oil discussion briefly, Joseph, out to internationally, because we hear that countries like Saudi Arabia and, when you look at OPEC Plus, that some of them wanted to ramp up production specifically just to squeeze out some of the U.S. frackers and some of the U.S. production. When you look internationally, any companies that surprise you with their output, or what do you think the lay of the land is as far as the global oil output?
Well, you remember that OPEC said that they were going to increase production in the month of May, June, July by 411,000. I think August 458, and then September over 500,000. They have increased quota, not real volumes. I'll just read the, see, I have the OPEC report in front of me, and in the month of July, they increased production by 263,000 to 27.5 million. But there were two countries that made the big part of the increase. Saudi Arabia went from 9.35 million to 9.53, and UAE went from 3.06 to 3.17, up 109, and then Saudi Arabia's up 170. But at the same time, you had Iraq down 51,000 to 3.9, and you had Iran down 12,000 to 3.25, and Kazakhstan was down. They're not an OPEC member. And surprise, surprise, China doesn't care what the Americans say about purchasing from Russia. Russia's production in the month of July went up 98,000 to 9.12. Their high water mark was 9.6. So they're not far, from if the latest thing, the reason why we're down so much with oil prices today is Trump is now talking that in, he could use the stick or the carrot. The stick is more sanctions, more third-party sanctions against buyers of Russian oil, as you may have heard, and that's why we had a buck down on Monday. Today, the stuff coming out of the Trump administration, which changes from day to day, as we all know, 180 degrees this time, they're talking now that they want to see American companies like ExxonMobil come back to Sakhalin Island, that they buy American, equipment for exporting LNG, that they buy other American equipment. So Trump is on the marketing side of the business part of oil, and he's using that as a carrot with Putin, versus before using the stick, which was what, the neocons want. And I think that incentivizing Putin will be a lot more successful than threatening him with the big stick.
Joseph, just a question regarding the OPEC plus countries. They seem to want to talk the market in a certain direction, but their production numbers consistently don't follow through, especially when they raise those quotas. Why is that? Can they simply just not produce as much as they would like to think, or is it just not profitable enough for them to do that?
Well, I think there's two issues. One, some countries, like I'll give you an example, Iran, their country was militarily was demolished, so they need all the cash they can get, so they sell to China and India, and all the money that comes in, barely keeps the economy going. So there's lots of problems there. Iraq has economic problems that are pretty serious. You go to Algeria, they haven't allowed any companies to come in there to drill. So you've got, government oil companies that are ineffective and not doing anything. You go to, countries like Kuwait, no spending on that. It's all spending on the government and largesse for the wealthy there. Nigeria always seems to have problems with, stealing of oil and, government having problems, getting the oil to market. And then, of course, you one after another. I think that the assumption here of the amount of production that can come on is just not there. And even if we get $80 or $90 oil, it will take some time for these countries to even wake up to the fact that they want to increase their production. I'd bring up one more thing from the EIA report last week. These prices, 63, 64, just don't work even in the US system. If you go to the Federal Reserve of Dallas, they talk about needing high 60s to mid 70s to justify a rate of return that's acceptable at a minimum return. And last week we had the data come out, and the production was 13.38 million, down from 13.4 a year ago. So we're producing in the States crude oil 18,000 below a year ago. That's a big negative, so the Americans need to. Trump wants cheap prices for, consumers to have cheap prices, but the industry can't make money at these prices. And so, they're not even going after their tier one inventory. They're cutting back budgets. You talk to anybody in the industry, in the service industry, there are rigs stacked up everywhere. Same thing with frack units. And so until the price of oil gets in the mid 70s, I don't think you're going to see much activity. Companies are going to take whatever cash flow comes in, pay down debt if that's a problem. And many of them have shareholder return issues where they're active buying back stock or they're paying dividends. And, they're listening to shareholders saying, don't spend money drilling more wells. We don't need that. Do it only when the price is incentivizing you to do that.
Yeah, so much for drill, baby, drill in this administration. And I don't know that the comments from Trump about wanting lower oil prices instilled a lot of confidence from the producers to grow and put more rigs on there. And neither is the price. And that was kind of the point with the OPEC Plus move to up production, was they wanted to squeeze U.S. producers. But let's shift the discussion over to nat gas. Talk about another sector that's languishing. Nat gas prices on the NYMEX below $3 now at 270 at the time of this recording, and not doing so great on the AECO either in Canada. So what's your outlook for nat gas, Joseph?
Well, we're sitting now with, of course, a warmer winter than people had expected. So I think that's the first part of it, is we need to have a moderate or a normal or a cold winter that draws down right away a lot of volume. The other one, of course, is there's more LNG plants coming on, new trains coming on before year end, which will add a few BCF a day of draw. So I think that's going to be a big help. So between winter and LNG exports, I think we may have a good market during the winter of 25, 26. The question is, how big of a draw do you have? Do you bring storage down to 1.5 TCF? And if that's the case at the end of winter, then prices will be firmer in 2026 in the spring and summer, because they'll have to fill storage. That's, just look what's going on in Europe. They had drained the storage more in winter of last year, so they've been paying a lot to fill storage with LNG, and that's why you have $15, $16 prices in Europe, is because they're desperate to make sure that they have enough gas for next winter. And if we start seeing big drawdowns in the States because of weather and data centers and exports via LNG, I think that's going to set the stage for a pretty dynamic natural gas market, but that might take into mid 2026 at the worst, if the winter is not cold. If the winter is cold, it could happen this winter.
So, Joseph, we covered the oil and natural gas sector last weekend show, more with the focus in the US too. And the one thing that really stuck out to me is the increased rig count in the US and what that usually leads to in terms of more supply in the near term, which to me really says that the natural gas price could still be under pressure, kind of what you're expecting into next year. What are we seeing in Canada, though? Are we seeing more drilling for natural gas like we are seeing in the US?
Yeah, let me go through the Baker Hughes data for last week. So U.S. total rig count last week was down 8%, so 538 rigs working versus 585. And as you said, gas rig count in the States is up 122 versus 97. I think a lot of that is in Pennsylvania, where President Trump went, and they're talking about more data center growth and big LNG usage. So I think that was part of it. But I think the Permian also, people are drilling more gassy wells, so to get the oil. Count in the States was 411, down from 483, down 14.9%. So $63, $64 oil definitely impacts the drilling activity for energy in the States on the liquid side. Going to Canada, the rig count was 56 for gas, down from 66, so down 15.2. So dry gas is definitely not being drilled. The liquids-rich Condy wells are being drilled. And the oil rig count, 123 versus 153, down 19.6. So even though you have the TMX pipeline with $63 oil, even with a 1.39 Canadian dollar, companies are saying, hey, maybe the economics are not as attractive. Let's wait and see if we can get $75 oil. And in the meantime, keep our balance sheets strong, keep the banks not worrying about us. And if we have a shareholder incentive plan, then let's keep on doing that so we keep the shareholders happy. So, companies like InPlay and Petrus and Hemisphere, continue to pay regular dividends. And in some cases, companies with strong balance sheets like Hemisphere, have paid two special dividends this year. Don Simmons and his team have done a fabulous job there. So I think what you need to do is just, do company by company. And we'll be talking about the ones who did the best. And I think we have six companies that we're profiling on the webinar, everything from a big company like Tourmaline down to a small company like Hemisphere, but ones that are doing very, very well. And we have one service stock, which is doing extremely well. So we're going to bring them up and just say, here's a story, here's why we like them, and here's what we think is a great price to buy them at. So, as you see with our research, that's an important thing. Clients want to know, where is the price of bargain? Where could it be a year from now? And where could it be in the top of the cycle? And we're still in the early stages. And you can see that by companies saying that they trade below PDP, proved developed producing assets, which, means you don't have to drill another penny worth, and there's more money in the PDP than the stock price. And then you go in the top of the stock market when things are frothy, and 2014 was really the last time that was the case. You had companies trading over 2P. So they were willing to pay for proven reserves and probable reserves, because they saw exploration upside, so they were willing to pay for more than 2P. So that's the cycle I see going into the end of this decade, and that's why I'm bullish. And what we say to people is, buy on weakness. Every time you get a bargain, when they get oversold, buy and build your positions. And before the end of the cycle, we may see three, four, five baggers across the board on the E&P sector, and that's what you're looking for. And also takeouts, where companies, will be, merging, because it might be cheaper to buy barrels on Wall Street and Bay Street than it is to go and drill them up. So we've seen that at market tops before. I think we're going to see it again.
All right, so some good thoughts there for the longer term trend that you expect to play out in the energy sector and using weakness and volatility as your friend to accumulate positions. A question we get a lot, Joseph, is when you look at the producers, where they're actually hedged at. So when you look at the muted price of oil and the muted price of nat gas right now, people look at that number that's trading on the futures market, but a lot of these companies are hedged at different prices. So how much do you look at that when you research these companies? How much of that plays into the strength of a company? And is that an advantage or a hindrance in this market?
Well, companies that hedged last year when they were able to hedge, $3.50, $4, do okay. Companies that have access to Dawn, which is a, $4 price market in Q2, did well. And, right now you can hedge all of 2026 in Canada at over $3. So the problem is the shoulder season. So spring and fall usually is where the price gets weak. The spring issue and the time of and summer is simply because pipelines are being built, and you have to shut in other pipelines that are connecting to it. You have facilities, compressor stations and other facilities that are going through maintenance cycles. And so that removes potentially a BCF from the market, and that extra is what drives prices down. And because it doesn't have a home to go to, it can't be moved, out of the province of Alberta or Saskatchewan or BC. And that's really the issue. The key thing for the upside is September, that those facility issues and pipeline construction are behind us because they get ready for winter. We'll probably see LNG Canada announce that they're better than 300-400 million a day. They're moving to a BCF a day. And they may also announce before year end that they're planning to, go for a second train, which would take it to 2 BCF. That would be very bullish for the sector as well.
Why have these LNG terminals been so slow to come online? They're such a catalyst for this sector. So many people are focused on them. There's a lot of money being spent building them, but they just always seem to get delayed.
Well, it's like any big facility that's $20-30 billion in construction. You got to go through the tweaks. Both the Americans and the Gulf of Mexico are doing it. We're now seeing it with our first one in Canada. The builders are including Shell, and Shell knows how to build them. So it's not incompetence. It's just the whole birthing pains of getting every piece of equipment to work with other pieces of equipment. And I think that's the issue that they're working on right now. They're talking about getting everything resolved in the coming weeks, so we'll have to wait for announcements. But if we can start hearing them say that we're heading to a BCF by November, you know, because you want that export during the winter time, because demand is going to be flush at that time in Asia, because they have cold weather and they're going to need the gas. They'll pay premium prices, and they might pay $14, $15 an MCF in US, which netting back to the Canadians is a big number. So I think I'd be watching LNG Canada, go to their website, and just watch to see when they talk about increases and that the problems that they've had are behind them.
Well, Joseph, this also brings up the larger discussion about having the infrastructure in place to get the gas to these LNG terminals, whether it's in the U.S. or in Canada, and some of the ones planned in Canada in the future. Love to get your thoughts on the infrastructure, the pipeline to get the gas there, but also if there's any thoughts you have on pipelines for oil, let's talk infrastructure, let's talk pipelines.
Well, the takeaway in Canada, you know, is there for meeting the U.S. needs right now. We have Alliance Pipeline, you have the TC Energy pipelines. Yes, you could tweak them and add some more volumes. Alliance may talk about doing a second line, and they're going to go and do some work and then go to the E&P companies and ask, see if they want to bid on the line. And if they get enough capacity demand, then they could, you know, build another pipeline. But the key one that's going to be is the West Coast. You know, do all the, you know, the 6-7 BCF of projects for LNG go through. Remember, you know, two of that BCF is just LNG Canada. You have Ellis, you know, the Key Kissimmee line. You've got Cedars. There's a number of projects there that if they all go ahead with announcements, FID announcements, final investment decisions this year, that would be very bullish. And I'm optimistic that we will see that. And the Prime Minister is going to Europe to try to show them that we're going to be a player. And then, of course, they're going to, you know, be, you know, he'll probably go to Asia, the same thing, and say, look, we can be a reliable supplier, and we're closer than the Gulf of Mexico and Australia. So, you know, dealing with us is an advantage and a diversification for your needs. And the security of supply, you know, isn't as much of an issue as bringing it in from the Middle East. So I'm optimistic, but again, is our Prime Minister just letting us hear what we want to hear, or does he come through with real real approvals? And I think that's something I'm hoping at this stage, that it's not just political batter, but reality, and that we do see more Western projects go ahead with First Nations approval.
It's going to be so interesting to see what or if these other trade deals happen outside of the U.S., because I feel like a lot of countries are feeling like they need to make some of these other trade deals. Who knows if they're going to come to fruition and even what that means for the U.S., but that's a whole other topic. Joseph, when it comes to the underlying equities, I've actually been pretty impressed at, let's just say, XLE, the large energy ETF. That's holding up much better than the underlying energy prices right now. It's only about 10% off of its recent highs from late last year. Well, energy prices have been fading quite a bit, and even recently it's been mostly trending sideways. So when you're looking at the whole wide options of energy companies, where are the best opportunities? Albeit, I guess we should couch that with, again, we're not at that screaming buy signal that you want.
Yeah. The XLE is at 87.62, down 0.8% today. 52-week high, 97.92. 52-week low, 74.49. April, of course, it was down there. So it's, you know, it's holding in reasonably well. Remember, Exxon is the biggest weight. Chevron is a big weight. They all have big dividends. So that dividend support is keeping the index up. A lot of producers which don't have dividends, those are the ones that are suffering. But when I go to Canada, I look at the companies in Canada, you know, you've got Freehold Royalties, which pays a 9 cents a month, a $1.08 dividend with an 8.2% yield. That can get up to a 10% yield, you know, when the stock gets down to the, you know, below around the 11 level or less. You've got Whitecap Resources with a 7.4 yield, a monthly dividend there. You've got Marin Energy, a company offshore, 30,000 BOED a day company, paying 20 cents, a nickel a quarter, 11.6% yield. You go to Alvopetro, which is Brazil, 9.5% yield. In-play oil, almost a 10% yield, a $1.08 dividend. And then you look at Petrus Resources, 8.2% yield. So there's lots of attractive yields with growth sides where the stock could go up 10, 20%, if I'm right, about $75 oil in the winter. So between the dividend and that, you could be looking at 20 to 40% total returns over the next 6 months. The key thing is these stocks might have 10% downside if we go down below 60, and if I'm right about 57 to 59 being the bottom between, late September, late October, then you'll have a chance to buy them at a cheaper price, 10% cheaper, with those the strong yields that are stronger than today. And then you have the upside where the stocks could go up 20, 30, 40% in the winter. And so that total return is really exciting. And if you take a look at them and see how good they are, go to the website, see the presentations, look at the webcast, listen to the webcast, and hear the question and answer from the analysts. That's the best way for you to get comfortable with the names. But the bottom line is, if I'm right that we are going to have a multi-year bull market, and that is because demand is going to grow in the third world for the nickel, the aluminum, the copper, all the cobalt, all the rare earths that we're going to need, they're going to use more energy to do that. People want to go from bikes to motorbikes to cars. They want, electricity in their homes, running water. And a lot of the third world, billions of people do not have that. And if we want their raw materials, they're going to have to want to buy into it, which means they need a better quality of life. So to me, the increase in the non-OPEC world, or sorry, non-OECD world, will be 7 to 9 million barrels between now and the end of the decade, while in the OECD, we probably will see a 2 or 3 million barrel decline as we use more EVs and as more fuel efficiency comes to bear. And I think that, in robo taxis, if that becomes a reality and people don't drive as much with their own vehicles. So to me, the big thing is the international growth in the demand. And if that asserts itself, we will see probably, 110, 120 on a regular basis for the WTI in, 2028 to 2030. And if there's any disruption in supply, and if you remember in 2008, we went from like 110 to 147. That was because there was no other supply, demand was strong, inventories were low, and OPEC couldn't bring on any more production. And then, of course, we went into the financial crisis of 08, 09, which, of course, knocked down the economic activity and demand came down. So, right now we've got a, let's say, a surplus of oil versus demand. By the wintertime, that'll switch around. And then the question is, how strong is that switch? How strong is the demand? And how low do inventories go when you have a cold winter? And remember, inventories for natural gas are at the high end of storage. Inventories globally for oil are at the low end of storage.
Well, Joseph, when I listen to you contrast some of the yields and payouts in the Canadian companies and where they may go if we see oil prices drop below 60 into the high 50s, and then think about the XLE, and like you were talking about with Exxon and Chevron, more of the US-based companies, there's a lot of pundits, even US pundits that we've brought on the show or I've read their articles, that are getting more and more animated by the discount, the differential between Canadian versus US oil producers. Could you maybe speak to that differential that a lot of them are pointing to? Even people that are big US investors are saying, hey, honestly, the Canadian oil stocks are just totally beat down here. So if they sell off by 10% more, would you be more weighted to Canadian players than US players based on that scenario?
Again, I don't spend time on the US players, so I really don't know the individual evaluations, but American companies, have traded over their PDP, proved developed producing. And again, American investors, it's a small weighting in the S&P 500, so they've got to go after the big weights. There's been mergers, which attracts a lot of activity. But in Canada, when you compare our numbers, PDP, discounts to NEV, price to cash flow, price to book value, yields, the size of the inventory, the depth of the inventory. You know, the Montney is bigger than the Permian, and people, you know, are beginning to realize it, that the reserve life of the Permian is not as long as the Montney, and it's shorter. And Tier 1 inventory is declining, while we still have a lot of Tier 1 inventory in Canada, subject to price. So I'm in the camp that, you know, the Canadian companies, you know, historically, if you go through the cycle, when things get bad in Canada, we have bad politics and there's low prices, the Americans sell out, you know, and you saw CNQ buying people, you know, Ovintiv sold out and became an American company, the former Encana. And so you see them leave. And historically, at markets when they're frothy and when there's a shortage of product, American and other companies come back into Canada and buy a lot of the Canadian industry up. You know, we've seen that in the past. I'll give you an example. Berkeley, Michael Rose has done this twice before. You know, he built up Berkeley, which was a Canadian and some U.S. assets, sold it to an American company, built up Duvernay, a very successful company, sold it to Shell International. So, you know, some of these big boys will come back and they'll be wanting to look at Duvernay. They'll want to be looking, or sorry, at Tourmaline. They'll want to be looking at Birchcliff. They'll be wanting to look at NuVista. And I think we'll see a significant amount of takeovers that will occur at the end of the decade at premium prices, which means the discount from PDP to 2P will be gone. And that'll mean probably five baggers or more with the takeouts into the end of the decade. So, you know, we're talking, it's, you know, more than midway through 2025, 4.5 years for five baggers. You don't get that often on that kind of an opportunity. And that's why I'm so bullish to take advantage of the corrections and load up the truck and go to, my view is that, and I'll be sending this out to clients, is if we get this next low risk buy signal in late September through late October, I'll be saying it's time to go to a fully invested energy position, depending upon what that is for you as an individual and your risk profile and your portfolio needs.
All right. So maybe just a little bit of patience for the investors in this sector. But look, we will follow up with you when we do get to that table pounding buy opportunity and the stocks that you see as having the best upside. But it does sound like a lot of potential opportunities when the underlying energy prices really turn around and start to build some upward momentum.
Yeah, one more thing I can mention, Corey. We have a conference in October on October 18th that you come to, and that Chad's going to be there this year. It's going to have over 40 E&P companies, you know, companies in the royalty sector. Topaz and Freehold are going to be there. A lot of service companies are going to be there. Some mining companies and critical minerals will be there for the energy industry of tomorrow. People can go to the Catch the Energy Conference website, catchtheenergyconference.com, and look at the what the program is, see pictures of the prior years, and if they want to come, you know, please sign up and get your tickets, and we'd love to see you at the conference.
All right. If you want even more information on that conference, feel free to email Shad or myself, and we'll put you in touch with Joseph and his team. Joseph, thanks for taking time with us on this weekend show. And everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all in North America, in the US and Canada, have a great long weekend. Really looking forward to getting the kids back to school and seeing what happens in the back half of this year with markets as everybody comes back to their desk starting at the beginning of the week. We'll see if there are any outside moves or any new trends developing in markets, in metals, or in commodities broadly, all of which you can hear on our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and through our Substack page. Just search DKE Report and tune in on a daily basis. Everyone, thanks for tuning in this weekend. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.